and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. Today, we have a special one-hour episode, a roundtable discussion on the DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea, which launched a satellite immediately drawing a rebuke and condemnation from the United Nations Security Council. Tensions are sky high again between the United States and the DPRK. We are talking about the DPRK, about North Korea, about the possibilities of a peace treaty between the United States and North Korea, or the possibilities of even greater tension. We're joined by Gregory Ellich. He is an advisory board member of the Korea Policy Institute, and Hyun Lee, who is also a member of the Korea Policy Institute, and they are both members of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace. Gregory Ellich from Columbus, Hyun Lee from New York, welcome.
Thanks, Brian, for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Last week, the DPRK launched a satellite. The UN Security Council went into emergency session and condemned the DPRK. Hyun Lee, let me ask you first, why is it when DPRK sends up a satellite, something that many, many countries do every year, that the U.S. and the United Nations, under the direction of the United States, act as if it's a great menace to world peace? What's the difference? Why the double standard?
Right. I think it's a good question because the Western media conveniently confuses a space launch vehicle, in other words, an SLV with a ballistic missile, whenever they're talking about North Korea. But, you know, we should make clear from the outset of this interview that they are two very different things. A satellite or a space launch vehicle puts a satellite into orbit, and then it falls back to Earth and then usually burns up in the process. A missile, on the other hand, goes up and then down and is supposed to land on a designated target. So it requires a very different kind of a guidance system. It requires a heat shield so that it doesn't burn up on re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere. It also obviously requires a warhead that can fit and can be is light enough to be carried. And I know that you had David Wright from the Union of Concerned Scientists on your show earlier, and he probably discussed this at length. But I think it's important to reiterate his point, which is that, you know, based on observing the shape of the trajectory as well as the burn time of the rocket that is launched, you can actually tell whether it's an SLV or a ballistic missile. And he concludes that the rockets that North Korea launched this Sunday, as well as back in 2012, they were both indeed intended to place satellites into orbit. They're not designed to launch long-range missiles. And, you know, of course, everyone points out that both use ballistic technology. This is true. You know, all satellites are launched by ballistic rockets. But, you know, as you point out, no other country that launches a satellite is ever the subject of condemnation, let alone a UN resolution. You know, satellite launches by various countries around the world happen all the time, as you mentioned. Last year alone, there were 80-some satellite launches. Just in the past month alone, the U.S., China, India, they all launched satellites into orbit. Japan has many satellites in orbit as well as advanced rockets, but, you know, its space launch vehicles are never described as ICBMs in disguise, although Japan could quite possibly turn its civilian nuclear and rocket capabilities into military assets, especially now that the Abe government is trying to undermine their peace constitution. So yes, of course, there definitely seems to be a double standard here.
Gregory Ellich, I want to ask you about the reaction in the political debates, in the among politicians, within the mass media. On the day that the DPRK launched the satellite, it was also the day that the Republicans were having their final debate before the New Hampshire primary. And so the moderator, in a very inflammatory way, asked them a question that was something like this, and I'm paraphrasing. The DPRK just launched an intercontinental ballistic missile test. They're trying to develop weaponry that can reach the western part of the United States or the mainland. Would you support a preemptive war against the DPRK? In other words, a preemptive war for the lay public means we just strike them. We carry out an aggression against them. And several of the candidates said yes, and none of them repudiated the question. What accounts for the very colorful, demonizing, and incendiary approach, not just by the Republicans, even though they may be the most grandiose at the moment, by so many politicians against the DPRK? What's really behind it?
Well, the DPRK is maybe the immediate trigger because it's one of the few countries that U.S. corporations don't have access to. It's sort of an outlier in the neoliberal international economic model. But I think the real target is actually China. So DPRK is a convenient foil for U.S. politicians to use to justify a military buildup, the Asia Pacific, to tighten the military stranglehold around China. Along those lines, they're already talking about serious discussions with South Korea on installing the THAAD. That's the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System in South Korea. This is a battery, anti-missile battery, supposedly aimed at potential North Korean missiles coming into South Korea. And it does have that capability, but what the U.S. officials and media don't tell you is the radar that accompanies the THAAD battery, the ANTPY-2 radar, it has two modes. It has a terminal mode in which it can detect incoming missiles and fire its anti-missiles to knock those down. But it also has a second mode, the forward-based mode, and that's detect missiles in the ascending phase. And it can, in other words, say if China were to fire a missile, this battery in South Korea, the radar, could detect that missile and communicate all the way back to U.S. anti-missile bases based in the United States, basically. So this is really, it only takes 8 hours to change the mode from one to another. So if this THAAD battery is installed in South Korea, it will effectively incorporate South Korea in the U.S. missile defense system, making it part of the military buildup against China. So I think the real aim of this anti-DPRK campaign is to justify a military buildup against China.
Hyun Lee, it may be that the United States, certainly after the Asia pivot, which President Obama announced in Australia a few years ago, which places a huge part of the U.S. Navy and Air Force into the Asia Pacific by 2020, that will be targeting the People's Republic of China. But for the people in DPRK or the DPRK government, when you have Republicans talking about preemptive war against the DPRK, they're going to think, hey, this is against us. I mean, politicians are talking about carrying out preemptive strikes and they could become the president of the United States. I mean, how does that rhetoric resonate inside the North, inside North Korea?
Well, I mean, I think they're totally irresponsible sound bites with no basis in knowledge of history or an understanding of reality. I mean, even if no one intends to start a war in Korea, an overreaction to a provocation could end up escalating into a full-scale war. And this is exactly what even U.S. generals stationed in Korea have warned about in the past. The Korean Peninsula is one of the most militarized places in the world. 4 million people died in the Korean War. 70% of them were civilians. Today, there are 28,000 U.S. soldiers in Korea and also hundreds of thousands of foreigners there. The U.S. is committed by treaty to fight with South Korea in the event of a war in Korea. So we can imagine how many U.S. soldiers and civilians would be killed in the first days of the war. I think I mentioned on the show last time that back in 1994, the Pentagon did a computer simulation of how many and projected how many deaths there might be if a war breaks out in Korea. And they projected 1 million deaths in the first few days. That was before North Korea was in possession of nuclear weapons. So obviously this type of, saber rattling and tough talk at the Republican presidential debates, they might sound good at getting attention among Republicans, but war is clearly not an option. And, unwillingness to return to talks and to negotiate a peace treaty to fundamentally resolve this conflict is not in anyone's interest, definitely not for people in North Korea or South Korea, but also in the United States.
Gregory Ilitch, let me also ask you to take us into a kind of a big picture, the historical context, because the Republic, and I want to focus again on the Republican candidates' talk about, yes, let's have a preemptive war, some of them said. At one time, the DPRK had suspended its nuclear weapons program, and then it decided to resume its nuclear weapons program, and it decided to leave the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and kick the inspectors out, and it said, we're going nuclear. I mean, they, of course, they didn't say it exactly like this, but in essence, what they were saying is, the political extremists in Washington, like George W. Bush, that I have identified us as part of an axis of evil along with Iraq and Iran, they mean business. They mean business, and we are not going to be the low-hanging fruit that Iraq was. And so we have to go nuclear. In other words, help us go through the different stages of when the DPRK decided to go suspend nuclear weapons programs, then return to them, and what the context was, because I think it's not a one-way street. There's reciprocity, and what people say in the West, what the politicians and the generals and the media say in the West actually does impact, not just on perceptions, but also on DPRK policy.
Going back to the Clinton administration, there was negotiated what was called the agreed framework, and that was actually came out of 1994 when Clinton actually was planning on attacking the DPRK over the nuclear program. For intervention by Jimmy Carter, managed to get agreement from Kim Il-sung, laying the basis for the agreement, and it kind of took the initiative out of Clinton's hands. But anyway, the following negotiations came up with a solution where North Korea would abandon its nuclear program in exchange, and not only to abandon its program, but it was in the process of building two nuclear plants that it needed desperately to supply electrical power. These were unlike the Yongbyon nuclear plant, which is a very small-scale experimental plant. These were large-scale nuclear plants that would be able to provide a significant amount of electricity. In exchange for ceasing construction of those plants and ceasing its nuclear program, the U.S. agreed that it would help organize an international consortium to build light water reactors that would supply electricity for North Korea. And these, unlike these plutonium-based nuclear reactors, it would be very difficult to get nuclear weapons-grade material out of these uranium, these light water reactors. And the U.S. also agreed that it would supply some heavy fuel oil on a monthly basis to North Korea in the meantime. Well, the U.S. The construction of these light water reactors was due to be completed by the year 2003. Well, the U.S. didn't even start build, and the consortium didn't even start building it until 2002 because the U.S. had calculated that North Korea would have collapsed before their part of the agreement came due, and that didn't materialize. So they delayed and delayed for many years construction of this plant. Then when Bush came into office, you know, and labeled the DPRK one of the axis of evil, and there were some tough negotiations where they basically were insulting the North Korean officials, and the Bush halted the shipments of heavy fuel oil. Basically, the U.S. at that point was no longer doing anything, and they had halted the construction of a light water reactor. The U.S. had abandoned every single one of its commitments under the agreed framework. And North Korea did not feel that it should alone adhere to this agreement when the other party was not. And under the terms of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, a country is permitted to withdraw from the treaty if it feels that its interests are specifically at threat due to nuclear issue. So that's when North Korea withdrew from the NPT. A few years later, there was an agreement in 2005, and where they would agree to freeze their nuclear program again. And on the U.S. side, the initial step that the U.S. was committed to take was to begin normalizing relations with North Korea. Well, instead of beginning to normalize relations with North Korea, within a matter of 2 or 3 days, the U.S. froze North Korean accounts at Banco Delta Asia. So that's one of the banks that North Korea was using for international trade. Treasury officials went to banks throughout the world threatening them that if they did business with Banco Delta Asia, and hinting that if they did business with any banks that did business in North Korea, that they would not be able to process their transactions through the U.S. banks, which international trade, all currency exchange is done through U.S. banks. So that would essentially close down any bank that was doing business with another bank that was doing business with North Korea. So rather than normalizing relations, the U.S. went the opposite way and was trying to strangle North Korea economically. So North Korea again withdrew from that agreement.
Well, thank you for that. That's a lot of territory to cover and extremely important for our audience, for people who maybe don't pay that much attention to Korea, but only sort of notice it when it becomes a splash, it becomes sensationalized news, it becomes a point of contention for politicians after, say, the recent satellite launch. Hyun Lee, help us understand the evolution of U.S. policy, because I think a lot of what the people in the DPRK would say is that the problem isn't in Pyongyang, the problem isn't in the leadership in Korea, in North Korea, the problem really is in Washington's policies. Gregory Ilitch said there was the General Framework Agreement in 1994, the U.S. was supposed to build light water reactors to compensate the DPRK for not having other kinds of nuclear plants. They were supposed to provide fuel for them. They dragged their feet on that. But at the same time, the Clinton administration looked like it might be on the path of normalizing relations with the DPRK. It dispatched Madeleine Albright to Pyongyang, and I think in 2000, there was the historic summit in June 15th, 2000, where Kim Dae-jung, the president of South Korea, who was a liberal within the South Korean political establishment, and Kim Jong-il met. It looked like there could be a thaw. And everyone thought, well, there could only be a possible thaw between North and South Korea if Washington approved, because Washington occupies South Korea. It has tens of thousands of troops there. Was the Clinton administration changing course, and instead of opting for a regime change and hoping for the collapse of North Korea, starting to ponder the possibility of an actual normalization?
Yeah. As you said, in 2000, when just picking up where Gregory left off, when the U.S. failed to deliver on its commitments in the agreed framework, North Korea threatened to resume its nuclear program. And that's when State Secretary Madeleine Albright went to Pyongyang in 2000, and North Korea agreed to stop its nuclear program in exchange for security assurance and normal relations. And they did come very close to normalizing relations. That was all scrapped, as Gregory mentioned, when George W. Bush took office. He threatened North Korea by calling it part of the axis of evil. And the U.S. put North Korea on a list of potential U.S. targets for preemptive nuclear strike. And that's when North Korea withdrew from the NPT, and the U.S. then initiated the six-party talks. And after many years of negotiations, Bush also came to the same conclusion that the best course of action vis-a-vis North Korea is to move towards normalization through direct talks.
We're going to have to pick this up after a short break. We're talking to Gregory Ilitch and Hyun Lee about the DPRK, North Korea. We'll be back after a very short break.
Loud and clear. And clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. We're joined by Gregory Ilitch from Columbus, Ohio. He's on the advisory board of the Korea Policy Institute and is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea. And from New York City by Hyun Lee, who is also part of the Korea Policy Institute and also a member of the same Solidarity Committee. Hyun Lee, we were talking before we went to break about how the Clinton administration's apparent attempt to normalize relations, the historic summit between the leadership of North Korea and South Korea, something that had not happened since the Korean War, took place in June 1950. And then George W. Bush came into office in January 2001, having lost the election, and immediately set to work to scuttle what appeared to be the outbreak of peace in Korea. Talk about it.
Yeah, so he put North Korea on a list of U.S. targets for preemptive nuclear strike. And this is what prompted North Korea to withdraw from the non-proliferation treaty regime. And it did resume its nuclear program. But, you know, at the end of his administration, Bush also appeared to move towards normalizing relations with North Korea. Bush did take North Korea off the state sponsors of terrorism list in 2008. In exchange, North Korea very dramatically blew up its nuclear cooling tower at Yongbyon. And then President Obama took office a few months after that, and we were completely back at square one. He adopted a policy of what they call strategic patience, which is basically waiting and preparing for regime collapse in North Korea. And in 2012, this was not covered very much in the Western media, but North Korea's foreign ministry made an announcement, and they basically said, we have engaged the U.S. in good faith for the past 20 years, and we've come to the conclusion that it hasn't, none of it has worked. We're done with trying to talk to the U.S. We're done with just talk for talk's sake. We will pursue a two-track policy, which is the development of our economy as well as development of our deterrence capability. So history shows that, you know, in the past, engagement has worked, but the current policy of strategic patience, basically waiting for regime collapse in North Korea, is not working, and it's precisely what has gotten us into this current crisis. And I just want to say that, you know, when Obama did come into office, there was the Leap Day Agreement between the U.S. and DPRK in 2012. That was the last and only attempt at formal engagement with North Korea by the Obama administration. And it fell apart precisely because of the issue I was mentioning earlier about the blurring of the definition between a satellite and a missile. In the agreement, North Korea, in exchange for food aid, agreed to a moratorium on long-range missile launches. A few months after that, it attempted to launch a satellite into orbit, and the U.S. claimed that this violated the agreement. And North Koreans disagreed. They said the launch of a satellite is very different from a long-range missile. And they also pointed out that, you know, more than 100 space vehicles are put into orbit by other countries every year worldwide. And the North Koreans apparently had already informed the Americans of their plans to launch a satellite even before the Leap Day Agreement was made. But nonetheless, the agreement fell apart and the U.S. refused to abide by its commitments in the agreement, saying the satellite was a missile. And we haven't had any attempted engagement since then. So, you know, this shows that there are real consequences to this blurring of, or this, you know, intentional blurring of the definition between what is a satellite and what is a missile.
Gregory Ilitch, I want to go back to you because you raised the issue that, in at least with THAAD, with the missile defense shield that's being established in South Korea, perhaps, which pretextually would be about North Korea or its satellite launch or a nuclear weapons test, but as you said, may be really directed against China. I want to talk about the relationship between the DPRK and the People's Republic of China. Of course, it's a historic relationship. The Chinese sent 1 million-plus volunteers to fight on North Korea's side during the Korean War. They pushed back the U.S.-led U.N. Offensive in North Korea. They pushed them back below the 38th parallel. A lot of Chinese people died. China shares a border with DPRK. They both say they're socialist countries. They're ruled by communist parties. What do you think is the durability of the alliance? Because it seems to me that part of the pressure on China right now is to get at least a section of the Chinese leadership to desire to break away from its historic relationship with DPRK and say, hey, it's just not worth it. They're doing their own thing. Everything the DPRK does ratchets up tension. In order to have peace, in order to have integration with the United States, in order to diminish the threat against us, let's just, you know, throw DPRK overboard, say the way Gorbachev threw Hungary overboard in 1988. What do you think?
Well, I think that's exactly right. The U.S. is intentionally trying to drive a wedge in between North Korea and South Korea. It's managed to...
Between North Korea and China, you mean?
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's what I meant. Basically, China and North Korea need each other. If North Korea were to collapse, U.S. would have put bases right on the border with China. North Korea, of course, relies on China for some of its food imports, a lot of its economic activity and oil shipments. North Korea has no oil of its own. And I think that's exactly why the U.S. is trying to drive a wedge in between them and put China in the position of thinking, well, okay, U.S. is using North Korea as a pretext to build up military threat against us. So, and to create a resentment against North Korea's nuclear program and satellite launches for antagonizing the U.S. Although in reality, the U.S. would only find some other pretext if it weren't for that one. And it's no coincidence that the draft U.N. Security Council resolution, as drawn up by the United States, specifically targets the Chinese-North Korean relationship. So let's look at some of the elements of this draft Security Council resolution. It would prohibit North Korean planes from entering Chinese airspace. It would block North Korean ships from docking at Chinese ports. And one of the most important features, it would ban Chinese food and oil shipments to North Korea. In other words, looking for the economic destruction of North Korea. Now, in North Korea, 80% of the country is mountainous, so it has very little arable land. It's going to always have to import food. China is one of the few countries willing to engage in food and normal trade with North Korea. So if you block food shipments, you're starving the population. If you block oil shipments to North Korea, you're basically shutting down the entire economy. This draft resolution would also ban mineral exports from North Korea to China. So these contracts to ship minerals from North Korea to China would be blocked. It would ban all international financial transactions with North Korea. So the U.S. is seeking nothing less than the total destruction of the North Korean economy and regime change. And this would put, as I said at the beginning, once that's achieved, assuming it could be achieved peacefully, which I don't think it could, U.S. troops right on the border with China.
So I want to just follow up with you, Gregory, if I could. Do you see divisions within the Chinese communist leadership or the Chinese government? There's clearly some forces within China who orient more towards the United States and others not towards the United States. Yeah. But do you see any visible differences within the government or within the Communist Party of China?
There's quite a bit of debate about that in the Chinese government and in the press even, and the population. So there is definitely a division of opinion on that matter. There's a segment of the population aligned with the business elites who want to go with the U.S. view. They don't want to have any disruption to their economic activity. And as a more traditional Chinese socialist viewpoint, that views North Korea as a partner, an ally from decades ago.
And where do you see Xi Jinping in that?
My impression is that he leans towards the U.S. Side.
Yan Li, the people in the making decisions in the DPRK have gone through the experience of the loss of one of their principal allies when the Soviet government collapsed, imploded, the Soviet Union was no more. That had a profound impact on the country because the Eastern European and Central European socialist bloc countries, along with the USSR, were principal trade partners. And there was a period of extreme economic hardship that wasn't just about that. There was also natural disasters and other things. But it would have to make you think, if you were in the leadership of the DPRK, even our principal allies may not be that reliable or may not even be there under some circumstances. So we have to have a position of complete self-reliance. There, of course, is the Chushe ideology, which emphasizes self-reliance. But just on a practical level, you'd have to be thinking, even if there are very big allied countries, socialist countries that are with us, they might not be there or might not willing to be there. Does that influence the thinking of the DPRK when it's making these kind of strategic military decisions?
Sure. I mean, as you said, in the 1990s, the DPRK went through extreme crisis. it calls the period of the arduous march. It was characterized by mass food shortages and people leaving the country across the Chinese border to look for jobs and to look for food. The DPRK's economy has recovered substantially since then, by all accounts from people who have traveled there recently. But, you know, self-reliance has been an ideology or philosophy that has guided North Korea for decades, since its founding. And the satellite launch should also be seen as part of this practice of self-reliance. It is part of North Korea's stated commitment to the development of science and technology. And it sees that as very central to being independent from foreign powers. It could rely on Russian satellites for GPS and communication and other things, but North Korea would rather have its own. And the fact that it was able to build a satellite launcher with its own technological know-how and not relying on imports from Russia or other countries is a source of tremendous national pride in North Korea. It should definitely be seen as part of its strategy of self-reliance.
The New York Times even said that, wrote an article the other day that said that, you know, while the rest of the world is denouncing the DPRK, that the satellite launch has created a sense of great national pride on the ground. This was the New York Times' own sort of independent assertion. Of course, for any government, how your population feels about you and feels about the nation while you're in a position of leadership is no small thing. The politicians in the United States, they always talk about, well, here's DPRK has no economy, and yet they can do satellite launches or nuclear weapons launches, even tests, I mean, or a hydrogen bomb test, but they have no economy. But that's actually not true. I mean, Hyun, I want to ask you about it. I mean, North Korea was an industrial country. As Gregory said, it didn't have much arable land, but it was a very industrialized part of the peninsula. And even until the 1970s or the early 70s, ahead of South Korea economically. So North Korea does not see itself as a backward country with no economy. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah. North Korea, until the 1980s, North Korea's economy was actually much more advanced and developed than South Korea's. And it is very much rich in mineral resources. So actually, this artificial division of the Korean Peninsula, divided between North and South, is pretty tragic when you look at the entire Korean Peninsula as a whole. The North is very rich in mineral resources, whereas the South is abundant in farmland, agricultural land. And so South is able to, is sort of the breadbasket of the Korean Peninsula. It is able to produce a lot of agricultural goods, whereas the North is very mountainous and it doesn't have a lot of land that is useful for agriculture. On the other hand, its mountains are very rich with mineral resources. That is actually a source of extreme wealth for North Korea. That is also why China has so much economic interests in North Korea. Despite the fact that it went through the period of the arduous march in the mid-90s, and despite surviving many decades of UN and U.S.-imposed sanctions, and also tremendous military threats from U.S.-South Korea joint military exercises, etc., North Korea has actually miraculously been able to turn its economy around. And so if you listen to the accounts of people who have traveled there recently, they are making great strides, not only in heavy industry, but also in sort of improvements in the day-to-day economic lives of ordinary people. One thing about its focus on sort of nuclear and satellite technology is that the reason why North Korea has turned to nuclear weapons development is because it's actually much more cost efficient as a form of deterrence rather than investing a lot of resources into developing conventional weapons technology. It would rather turn its resources into developing its economy for the people rather than so much on defense. But when you're a small country facing military threats from the largest military force in the world, you have to spend resources on deterrence capability. But, if there ever comes a point where North Korea and the U.S. could actually sit down and resolve this more than 60-year-old conflict and finally end the Korean War, then, of course, North Korea as well as South Korea can start to return resources that they're using on defense to improve the lives and the livelihoods of the people.
We're going to have to break away for a short break. We're talking to Gregory Ilitch and Hyun Lee about DPRK and the Korean Peninsula. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking to Gregory Ilitch and Hyun Lee. They're both members of the advisory board of the Korea Policy Institute in the United States, and both are members of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea. We've been talking about the possibilities of economic, right before we went to the break, about economic development in the DPRK. I was in the DPRK twice in 2001 and again just in 2013. And even though 2001 may not have been the darkest moment compared to some periods of the mid-1990s in what you called the Arduous March or what they called the Arduous March, I could see in a palpable way, obvious way, that economic conditions had greatly improved in 2013. There was car traffic. There was a lot of hustle and bustle. You could see the people were not starving. There was just a lot of activity. And, of course, one thing that you can always gauge a society by is what the children look like. And we saw, again, unaccompanied children walking with confidence and security and safety on the streets of Pyongyang. We even went to smaller towns. Of course, the economic development in the capital city is greater than it is elsewhere. But there, too, there was palpable signs of real, real improvement over the last 10 or 11 years. So that seems to me, as an observer and a casual observer, not someone who knows a great deal about DPRK, that's obviously happening. And that has to give the government there some degree of confidence about what they're going forward to. We talk a lot about DPRK, and again, I think it's one of the reasons I think the show is so important is that people in the United States only get a demonized version of the DPRK. The last time I went to the DPRK, I came back and I said to people who I live with in my neighborhood, I said I was just in North Korea because they wanted to know where I went. And they said, oh, you mean South Korea? And I said, no, I mean North Korea. And it was like it actually didn't compute, like their signals got crossed. They couldn't conceive of people from the United States going to the DPRK. They just thought like that's entering hell or something like that. So there's this completely demonized version of DPRK. But people also don't know what things are like in South Korea. I think the image generally is South Korea is free and democratic and capitalist, and that's what makes it free and democratic. And the North is authoritarian, totalitarian, and communist, and that's what makes it a repressive regime. Gregory Ilitch, you have, along with Hyun Lee, have done a lot of work, not just about DPRK, not just your writings, but analysis and work trying to promote solidarity and justice. talk about what's going on in South Korea, because there has been a gigantic crackdown on democracy and on progressive political activity and political parties.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's a story that we don't hear in the U.S. media at all. Let's go back to the election of South Korean President Park Geun-hye in the first place. And the National Intelligence Service, which is a South Korean counterpart of the CIA, was involved in the election campaign. So they had staff who were devoted to spending their entire work days posting on the internet and sending tweets under the cover of being ordinary citizens, basically defaming the liberal candidate who was running against Park Geun-hye and also other liberal and left candidates in order to sway the election in her favor. And I believe that the tweets and the posts and all amounted to hundreds of thousands of posts and tweets. And the election, I think, was only about like 3 or 4% difference, so that could well have swayed the election in favor of the conservative candidates. Well, since Park Geun-hye has taken office, there's been an all-out assault on democracy and labor. So there were large weekly demonstrations in downtown Seoul and other locations in South Korea protesting the intervention by the National Intelligence Service in the election. And I think at one point they grew to like something like 30, 40,000 people in Seoul. And these were led by progressives, particularly the Unified Progressive Party, which held, I think, if I remember correctly, 6 seats in the National Assembly. And there was also the National Intelligence Service had an informer in the Unified Progressive Party who recorded some meetings that had taken place, party meetings. And the National Intelligence Service leaked what it claimed were transcripts in which supposedly the National Assemblyman Isak Ki, who was a member of the Unified Progressive Party, was advocating in the event of war with North Korea that they would attack South Korean facilities and they would take up arms. And they're talking about revolution and, you know, armed revolution and so forth and so on. So under the basis of that, the transcripts that were released to the media, and the party was, in essence, judged by through the media and to create a furor against them. And that, following that, there were court cases where Isak Ki and 5 other members were arrested and tried on charges of treason, basically. I forget the exact charges, at any rate. And these transcripts were a major part of that the trial. And it turned out that the transcripts were bogus, that the National Intelligence Service had deliberately mistranslated what was actually said in order to make it seem threatening. So there was actually no case of treason there. But they were still convicted anyways. So on appeal to the Supreme Court or High Court, the defendants were found not guilty of this action, but they were convicted anyways. So on that basis, and simultaneously with that, the government had submitted a request to the Constitutional Court to ban the Unified Progressive Party. And the Constitutional Court ruled in favor of the government. So the Unified Progressive Party was banned from existence. Its assets were seized. The first time, I believe, since democracy came to South Korea, ostensibly, that a party has been banned. Other actions have been taken. The Government Employees Union has been banned. The Teachers Union has been outlawed. There have been labor demonstrations against the government is pushing through a labor reform act in which it would basically strip workers of protections against arbitrary dismissal and would extend the terms of temporary employment. So it would greatly expand the use of temporary and insecure labor, and it would institute a program where when workers reach a certain age that they would have their wages would be cut. So the labor unions have been, led by the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, have been leading demonstrations against that. The police have been attacking them. with water cannon mixed with hot pepper. And in one case, there was one farmer who was part of the demonstrations protesting against the free market agreement that would restrict the rice growers' ability to survive, that he was hit by a water cannon and had suffered brain damage. He's been unconscious ever since. So there's an all-out assault on labor and dissent. And, of course, they use a national security law. So anybody who the government claims says something that's pro-North, which is defined so broadly that it covers almost any criticism whatsoever, can be arrested. So there's even been a case where somebody was posting articles from North Korea not in support of the articles he was supporting, but as a matter of information, and he was arrested and jailed as well.
Let me ask Hyun Lee about that. So, because, again, the American people actually don't know that much about anything politically that's going on in Korea. In South Korea, what Gregory Ilitch is saying is that if you post on the if you post or share on the internet some source or news source from the DPRK, even if you don't agree with it, you can be arrested. And the political parties that are against the most right-wing forms of government or may want to have a thaw or a normalization of relations with the North, with DPRK, they have been suppressed and their leaders are now in prison. I mean, yeah. And this is taking place when the U.S. is occupying still South Korea. So those kind of governmental decisions and repressions and laws that are so prohibitive and against free speech or free assembly, they have to be done with the connivance or at least the green light of U.S. authorities. And yet we don't hear anything about the lack of democracy in South Korea.
Yeah. And I think it's no coincidence that with the U.S. pivot to the Asia Pacific region, that what we're seeing is, U.S. alliance with these governments that are basically reintroducing authoritarian practices. So same thing in Japan under the Abe government. They're trying to change the peace constitution so that Japan can become another military force in the region again. And the U.S. has supported that. There's definitely a crackdown on people who... peace activists and other people who have been protesting against the Abe government in South Korea. Again, the U.S. is very closely allied with the Park Geun-hye administration. She is the daughter of a former dictator, Park Chung-hee, and she is introducing practice that basically hark back to her father's military rule. Like you mentioned and Gregory mentioned, the administration routinely uses the national security law, which basically makes illegal anything that seems to say anything in favor of North Korea. It's talk about North Korea in any sort of positive light. They've used this law to imprison labor leaders for opposing anti-worker policies. They've used this law to jail a dissident lawmaker, to dissolve an opposition party, to outlaw unions. It is also the South Korean government is also trying to introduce a state-authored and state-mandated history textbook. This has sparked a public outcry. And also, most recently, the most egregious of all is in the interest of advancing the U.S.-Japan-South Korea trilateral alliance, President Park recently announced an agreement with Japan that essentially silences former comfort women, women who were trafficked and exploited as sexual slaves by the Japanese Imperial Army during World War II, and they've been fighting for redress for decades. Basically, this agreement says they will no longer talk about this issue in exchange for some money from the Japanese government in so-called compensation. And you know, the Park Geun-hye government has been, or the her administration has been characterized by many multiple crises. As Gregory mentioned, there was the illegal involvement of the intelligence service in the presidential election that got Park Geun-hye into office. There was also the Sewol tragedy, where hundreds of high school students died in a ferry that sank, and there is still a lot of questions about government involvement in that tragedy and what the government did or didn't do in response to the tragedy. Each time, basically what the South Korean government has done is exploit fears of the so-called North Korean threat to distract from domestic problems. There is an election coming up in April, it is speculated that the ruling party, which is aiming for a two-thirds majority through this election, if it does gain two-thirds majority, it has plans to change the South Korean constitution to create a semi-presidential system so that Park Geun-hye can be appointed as prime minister and continue to rule the country. So, yes, democracy is definitely under threat in South Korea, and this is something that's not ever talked about in the Western media.
And another thing that's not talked about in the Western media is that the origin, the genesis of the South Korean government is rooted in the old Japanese colonial domination over the Korean people. I mean, Park Geun-hye's father, who was the dictator until he was assassinated in 1979, I believe, and I think he was the dictator for a long time, like maybe almost 20 years, he had served in the Japanese colonial army. He was part of the overseers and the oppression of the Korean people, and then he, along with many others, were sort of handpicked by the U.S. occupation forces after the end of World War II to become the new government in South Korea. And they imposed this military dictatorship, which, tell me if I'm wrong, Gregory, it was until about the mid-1980s or 1988, where the people in South Korea even had the chance to have some sort of democratic process.
Yeah, 87, if I remember correctly. And as you say, Park Geun-hye was a collaborator within the Japanese Imperial Army. Actually, after the U.S. forces entered South Korea at the end of the war, there were people's committees that blossomed forth spontaneously throughout Korea, just both north and south, like a people's democracy, where they were taking the hands of government and And the U.S. didn't like that trend, because it's obvious that these people were involved in labor movements and farmers movements and so forth, and the U.S. wanted more like the elites in power. So they deliberately brought in Koreans who had collaborated with Japanese, who had powerful business interests. And actually, there are many cases where Japanese prisoners and police that the U.S. had arrested after the war were given arms and actually told to go ahead and suppress these movements. So they actually had turned loose some Japanese former oppressors to continue doing the same in order to stamp out these people's committees.
So that's extremely important history. I hope that people can learn more about history. If you want to find out about Korea, if you want to find out that which you're not learning from the corporate-owned media, I would recommend that you go to the Korea Policy Institute and to the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea. Hyun Lee, in just 5 or 10 seconds, how can people get the information that you guys are providing?
I think people should definitely go on the website of the Korea Policy Institute, which is kpolicy.org. And also look forward to a new news blog that the Solidarity Committee for Peace and Democracy in Korea will be launching at the second half of this year. It's called Zoom in Korea. It's dormant right now, but it'll be up and running again in July.
Okay, thank you very much. Gregory Ellich and Hyun Lee, they're both members of the advisory board of the Korea Policy Institute. You can Google it, Korea Policy Institute, and the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, It has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.